Welcome to Trade Off, the podcast about the people, politics, and power inside Europe's trade policy. I'm Tom Moylan. Together, we'll explore the stories of the people who shape and steer trade. We'll get to the bottom of why trade matters, how it works, and why people are passionate about it.
At the beginning of May, we saw the much-celebrated entry into force of the EU's most recent trade agreement with New Zealand. 6 years of intensive work. It might appear long, but is it? That New Zealand can do it, a democratic, mostly English-speaking country, with a single house representing around 5 million people, it's not too astonishing. But the EU, 27 member states, 450 million people, 24 official languages with a parliament, a council and a commission sharing power, and a myriad of stakeholders across the continent who want to have their say too. How is it possible that the EU manages to conclude trade deals? How does it work? And what is at the heart of it?
It's a power game. It's like a poker game. Everybody does a bit of bluff.
It's a give and take. And it's also a question of trust.
Trust is the foundation, that there comes a moment in a negotiation when you need to trust your counterpart.
We're negotiating not for governments, we're negotiating for people.
So it's about power and trust, about give and take, and ultimately it's about people. So let's get into the weeds. How did it all start? Before a negotiation can formally start, both sides, the EU and the partner country, need to agree that a free trade agreement is what they both want. Maria João Botelho represents Portugal at the table of member state senior experts. They discuss trade policy on a monthly basis, and she was very much involved in those discussions at the time.
We were very much supportive since the very beginning of the negotiation. We think that it's trade agreement and trade agreement with New Zealand. It's much more than trade. It's geostrategic because it's a country in the Indo-Pacific region where we want to be.
At the same time, New Zealand was also keen to negotiate with the EU. Vangelis Vitalis, New Zealand's chief negotiator, knows why.
We were confronted with a very big challenge, which was that our position in Europe was beginning to erode. We were finding that many of our competitors were negotiating free trade agreements with the European Union, and as a consequence, our position in the market was becoming smaller and we were less competitive, not because our products were not good, but because the tariff we faced was higher than that of our competitors. We were being confronted by many of our exporters saying, listen, the Chileans are now in the market on kiwi fruit. We're still paying the 8.4% tariff, and they are not.
Bernd Lange, long-standing chair of the European Parliament's Committee for International Trade, also considered New Zealand as an important partner and supported the launch of trade negotiations.
New Zealand is, of course, a like-minded country. Huh? New Zealand is really European, perhaps the most European country outside Europe. Huh? I got a present last time when I was in New Zealand. It was after Brexit, and they had a map of Europe, deleting Britain and putting New Zealand in, and it fits in. Huh? So therefore, also the mindset was clear, huh? That it is really more or less on the same track.
I knew that this would be a hugely important deal for my country. And I also knew that it would require some very tough decisions. And this is the challenge we faced was then how to get started with the European Union. How do we make the case for the European Union, a colossus?
So how does it all get started? For the EU, that means all 27 member states together instruct the Commission to launch negotiations. And they set out in quite a lot of detail what the Commission should achieve and what the Commission should not put on the negotiation table. All this is captured in what is called the mandate, or in legal terms, the negotiating directives.
The negotiating mandate is important to frame the negotiations. But in our view, it should not be too prescriptive. Because I think, you know, the Commission is the negotiator, but there has to be some margin, some latitude for the Commission to negotiate compromises.
And once all 27 member states had approved the mandate for negotiations with New Zealand, it was the main point of reference for Peter Bertz, the EU's chief negotiator.
And the mandate finally adopted by the Council was for me then the instructions, what to do, how to negotiate, but also again in broad terms, respect agricultural sensitivities, do not go for full liberalization.
And then, very importantly, the mandate should also be made public.
We have the policy publish already the drafts of our mandate. We submit to the Council. Then, of course, it's up to the Council to decide on the publication of the adopted version.
The mandate should be publicized because that's the beginning of the process and it has to be transparent.
So, while the Commission proposes the draft mandate and the 27 member states and the Council approve it, the European Parliament does not have a formal role at the beginning, but it is still very much involved right from the start and for good reason.
Yeah, it's totally clear. We have to say at the end of the game, yes, no, or postpone and wait until our conditions are fulfilled. And we really should use this power, and we are using this power. In the case of New Zealand, it's giving a clear signal regarding labor rights, regarding sustainability and so on. And this was also mostly taken on board by the Council.
And then negotiations with New Zealand were launched shortly afterwards. The team sitting at the negotiation table is composed of Commission officials. To ensure the position they take and defend in the negotiation process corresponds to what the Parliament, member states and stakeholders from the EU want, they're in almost constant contact with the relevant committees in both the Council and the Parliament, as well as with stakeholders from across the European Union. But we'll come to that later. First, let's take a closer look at how deliberations are steered in the Council. There's a system of rotating presidency, and while the member state holding the presidency does not have any form of increased power, it is the focal point for a lot of the coordination behind the scenes. In the case of negotiations with New Zealand, Portugal held the presidency for the first 6 months of 2021, when negotiations were in full swing. Bert Lange and Maria João Batello will explain how that went.
The role of the presidency is, of course, to hold the Council together and inform them. And regarding the Portuguese presidency, of course, it's really great that they are really pro-trade member state.
So we would like to have that concluded in our presidency. But clearly, we knew since the very beginning that time was not right for that. We tried to advance the negotiation as much as possible. We had meetings with all the 26 member states, with Bernard Lang, with Vangelis, the negotiator, to try, and with the Commission, of course, to try to understand what we could do to help and push forward.
And they have really a sense how important reliable and stable relations are. And then, of course, there's a little bit more push and more engine behind the work than perhaps normal.
So we made what is, I think, possible for a member state that does not have the power to negotiate to try to help push forward.
But as Peter Bert said earlier, in the end, a negotiation is not for governments, but must be in the interests of the people. And how can negotiators be sure they are negotiating in the interest of European people, workers, farmers, entrepreneurs and consumers? A key element to ensure everyone who has a stake in negotiations can see, read and hear what is happening? That's transparency.
Transparency is important for people to trust in the negotiators. To trust means to know. So they have to know what is at stake, what has been discussed, what can be the landing zones. I remember when we discovered that ACTA was making a lot of fuss and we didn't realize because we didn't know anything about that. So it's really important to keep people informed all along Member states should be informed by the Commission. Commission should also give information to the Parliament, because they have, in the end, to say yes. And every national member states have to explain that to their, to our national parliaments, to companies, to people.
We wanted to ensure that throughout the process, also including and up to the launching of the negotiations, we are working in a transparent manner, not only with the member states, but also with civil society, NGOs, to ensure that on one hand, there is awareness what we are doing, and to ensure that everybody is aware, feels comfortable with the European Commission negotiating in a transparent manner and preparing these negotiations in a transparent manner, not behind closed doors and then being faced after 5-6 years with a 4,000 pages of free trade agreement.
Indeed, if you look at how trade policy was done 10 years ago, things are done very differently now. Just look at the number of documents that are now publicly available on the Commission's website. The Commission's proposals for negotiation mandates, round reports, EU text proposals, and much more. And how did New Zealand perceive the EU's approach to transparency? Vangelis Vitelis told us.
I'm now a very big believer in the importance of transparency as a critical part of sustaining a social license for trade policy, wherever you are. And actually, I found that the more you shared information and were able to explain some of those very challenging kind of problems that you faced, the more and the better the understanding.
Now, is there such a thing as too much transparency?
Transparency is very important. We came a long way to develop our transparency policy. We publish our draft mandate, we publish our initial texts, but during the negotiations, certainly we don't publish offers. Offers in terms of market access for goods, services, procurement.
Now, the reality is that often you are not able to talk about all parts of the negotiation. So there are moments when transparency is actually a problem. And let me give you a very practical example. In, I think it was in 2020, in June, the EU had given us a first goods offer and we had received it. But within 24 hours, it became a public document.
And unfortunately, one of these offers in the middle of the negotiations was leaked.
It was leaked at the European Union end. That form of transparency was not helpful because it forced New Zealand to respond at a political level. And my minister was incandescent, is an understatement.
I understand the reaction from the New Zealanders that they had to come out also at a political level and cry foul, basically, and say, this is certainly not a trust-building exercise here. So it was all in all not helpful for both of us. And thankfully, nothing like that happened again during the negotiations.
So a recurring theme in the discussions we had was trust. And that is particularly important when negotiations are at a critical juncture. In the case of New Zealand, this was literally just before the leaders got ready to announce a conclusion of negotiations in front of the entire press corps.
A poker player has cards in his hands, which the other person cannot see. My role as a chief negotiator, especially in these negotiations, was upfront, create necessary level of trust with my counterpart. That means we mainly played with open cards.
There comes a moment in a negotiation when you need to trust your counterpart. And you need to trust your counterpart at that moment when he or she says to you, I can do this or I can't do that. And you need to trust them. So our leaders, they'd essentially concluded the negotiations. And as I was sitting there, it was in this small room, I could feel my phone going, but of course, in front of, you know, the president of the European Union and your own prime minister, you don't pull out the phone. And then finally someone came in and tapped me on the shoulder and said, look, listen, can you come out? We have a problem. And I then fielded a phone call that made it clear that this could all still fall over unless we found additional language to be inserted into the text.
I vividly remember that moment. I had to call Vangelis out of the meeting of the leaders, and I knew he would take the call because he knew. When I call him at that moment, at that critical juncture, then it has to be important. And he took the call.
Yeah, I mean, I still break out in a cold sweat when I think of that moment. And Peter and I needed to find the right language to capture this point. We were able to take that decision, but there was that moment of a sense that was this the European Union trying to extract a last minute concession, or was this a genuine problem? And that goes back to the trust question. Trust is the foundation.
We managed to get over it, and that is a consolidation of the trust we have in each other, because we knew when we call each other, it's important.
So let's look in more detail at how stakeholders are consulted and how their views feed into a consolidated negotiation position, because surely not everyone has the same priorities. Families might be happy to find a wider choice of dairy products in the supermarket, but French producers of butter are concerned about their competitiveness and therefore about more butter coming from New Zealand into the French market. How do those involved in the negotiations square these circles?
We have a close daily connecting and involvement with the Minister of Economy, with the Minister for Agriculture, with our Export and Investment Agency, and they reach out with stakeholders, and then they assess their positions, their interests, their fears, their sensitivities.
Of course, we have a lot of contacts to business people. Also, specifically in the case of New Zealand, we had a lot of discussion also with the agricultural sector. We discussed with trade unions, with civil society.
So often I found that the opportunity to speak with people directly was absolutely critical. And people are actually fair-minded. And when you turn up and you have that discussion with them, well, I could see what they were concerned about. And I could see that anxiety. And I could understand then, okay, this is why Peter is so worried about this part of the negotiation.
No, consulting stakeholders is, of course, the bread and butter of our negotiations. The constant feedback, what is on the table? What do we want? Does it still match? Do we need to go further? Have we given up too early, etc.? That is a constant process throughout the negotiations. And that goes on both ways. We consulted also stakeholders in New Zealand. After all, as chief negotiator, you have to balance out the offensive interest between all interested parties.
I think we have come a long way. When I started, we basically wanted to protect our traditional industries. But with economic crisis, companies really had to go out. By that period, the driver of our growth was exports. So now what we have is companies wanting new markets.
I had an afternoon off before I moved back to my chief negotiator meeting, and I went to see the Weta Studios, where they produced The Lord of the Rings. I was introduced by my colleague from the embassy as Peter Behrens, and the lady selling tickets said, "Oh my God, you are Peter Behrens, the negotiator for the trade agreement. My mother has a flower shop, and she can't wait for the entry into force of UFTA so she can export her flowers more cheaply to the European Union." I must say, I was baffled when I heard that. Just imagine the flower shop on Rond-Point Schumann, knowing anything about New Zealand, not to mention a new trade agreement. Unthinkable. But here, a nice example how a trade negotiations triggered down to the level of a flower shop owner.
Let's zoom out again before we finish and look in more detail at the role of the European Parliament. Elected by voters in all member states to represent the people's interests, the Parliament has steadily gained powers through successive amendments of the European treaties, which have given more and more clout to the EU's only directly elected body. The European Parliament is a co-legislator on trade matters alongside the Council, so each concluded trade deal must be approved by the European Parliament before it can be implemented.
Trade policy is now clearly EU-only competence, and it is also now trade-related agreements or legislation is in the hands of the International Trade Committee. This is really new, and we appreciate this democratization of one important policy area quite well. By the way, this was not really recognized from everybody. I remember quite well, 2010, I got a telephone call from a Secretary of State from a big member state asking me Is this really true that you have now the last word in a trade agreement? Yes, I said, please read the Lisbon Treaty. Yeah.
So what are the implications of this powerful role?
You know, the parliament is not only involved when it has to give its consent, but it needs to be prepared to give this consent, to feel comfortable that we deliver a deal that is also reflects the interest of the European Parliament's groups. Before and after rounds, I had personal contact with the rapporteur. We reported back to Intercommittee itself, but not only to the trade side, but also to the AFED side and to the Friends of New Zealand group, which was also very helpful to gain the necessary support in the European Parliament for these negotiations. Here, the constant engagement with individual MEPs as well was crucial then to get a support of the European Parliament that was quite remarkable in terms of positive votes we achieved.
Indeed, in the case of the EU trade agreement with New Zealand, the European Parliament not only voted in favour with a large majority, but also processed the agreement much faster than previous trade agreements. So while New Zealand was doing everything it could to move quickly on their side, for the EU, this was in fact the fastest trade negotiation and ratification procedure the EU had ever completed. Vangelis Vitalis and Bernd Lange remember the process.
It was impressive to see how the Parliament itself geared up to respond to this new trade agreement and brought together and understood the value that this agreement would bring.
It's possible to have this really speedy negotiation process and the speedy conclusion of the agreement. And we established inside the European Parliament so-called monitoring groups so that we have really and close contact with the negotiators, what's going on and what the Parliament could fit in and feed in. We as Parliament really try to have also a clear perspective on obligations for the core ILO conventions and the UN environmental standards and the Paris Climate Agreement as an obligation in such a trade agreement for both partners. And we were really proud that this agreement was coming into force on the 1st of May, the International Day of Labour, and we had the most advanced labour chapter ever in the trade agreement.
It's easy to for outsiders to say, oh, the Parliament is chaotic and so on. That wasn't my experience at all. This was a very impressive operation, how the Parliament brought this agreement together and, if I'm honest, much more quickly than we expected, took it through the procedures there. I mean, the embarrassing fact is that it actually took New Zealand longer to bring the agreement into force than the European Parliament.
So at the end of the day, who is pulling the strings? Is it the Council, the Commission, the Parliament? When asking that question at the end of the interviews to Maria João Botelho, Bert Lange, Peter Bertz, Vangelis Vitalis, it was remarkable that there was no clear answer. And it was also remarkable that each of them mentioned at least two different institutions.
Well, I think the Commission is the powerful in the game. They have all the cards.
So at the end, of course, it's the Council that decides on the conclusion of this agreement with this consent of the European Parliament. So Council and European Parliament are on equal footing in that respect.
I'm convinced that, of course, the Commission and the Parliament, they are sitting in the driver's seat. So it's not totally decided who is really putting the petrol into the engine.
The Council also. And the Parliament, the Commission cannot conclude anything without the Council and the Parliament. That gives us, it's an asset of the Council.
We knew we needed the Parliament on side. Herr Lange, of course, was a very a formidable chair of that process. But look, it is certainly true that the Commission has competency for trade. So in the end, yes, you could talk to Paris, you could talk to Lisbon, you could talk to Rome, but in the end you knew that actually in Brussels the decisions would eventually be made, but those decisions would be informed by what was happening in those capitals. So we did know that all of the pieces need to come together. We needed to be aware how Paris was thinking about this, what was happening in Berlin, what were they thinking in Bucharest.
So, in the end, there does not seem to be a clear centre of gravity. Neither council nor parliament nor commission seem to dominate the game, but institutional power is shared between all three. And what animal could represent the EU as a negotiating partner?
Can be a mythological. A Nydra, because of the several heads. So I would say that, a Nydra.
I'm from the north of Germany, and I would perhaps compare it with a ship as a tanker. So it's not so easy to change the course of the tanker. But if you are on track, then you have really a big power behind.
It's rather an elephant, so big in size, slow in movements, but also sensitive when it comes to, in saying with the picture, a mouse in front of it.
Look, the most obvious example is the elephant. And the huge size, the relatively slow moving, but once it gets moving, it's an inexorable force. And it really gets things done. It is a big beast to get your arms around. And for an elephant, you can't get your arms around it.
So, this is how trade policy is done by the EU. But whether the EU is acting like a hydra, a tanker, or an elephant, in the end, the EU is able to deliver. And where the most immediate result may be a beautiful legal document of 4,000 pages, when all's said and done, it is an agreement negotiated not only for people, but also by people. People who believe in trade and are passionate about it.
It's, as I mentioned before, it's a power game. You have to anticipate, you have to be strategic, you have to be tactical, you have to connect with people. So there are a number of dimensions when you are discussing trade that is so overwhelming and so important. So companies pay more salaries when they export and they do trade. People are more prosperous because of trade. So that gives a sense of purpose. And because it can make the difference on the people's life.
Trade-off is brought to you by the European Commission.